Spirit Radio Podcasts.
So vaccine passports, what are they all about and how are they going to be used? Is it something you would like to see, or do you think it's a bad idea just in terms of these types of passports being used for things like EU travel, or what about for large events and concerts? Or do you think they will discriminate against people who choose not to get a vaccine? On the line to give us his thoughts, we have David Thunders, political philosophy researcher and lecturer at the University of Navarra's Institute for Culture and Society. We'll start with that, David. Just tell us a little bit about the current vaccine passports that have been mooted and the idea behind them and what they're going to be used for.
Yeah, thanks, Wendy. The European Commission has proposed a digital green certificate for the European Union. And basically, this certificate would be used as a way of certifying that you have, in fact, been vaccinated when you arrive into any EU country. And then that country can decide how to act on that information at its own discretion. But the essential idea is to ensure that people who get on planes and people who travel have either been vaccinated or have tested negative for COVID. So the logic behind this kind of proposal is to reduce the possibility of infections with COVID-19.
You've written recently, David, that you think that this could lead to a division and public unrest. Why do you think that?
Well, basically, this idea is now being used not only in international travel, it's also being used, say, in Israel to allow to screen people for admission to cinemas, to restaurants, to concerts, to sports events. And so it has the potential to be expanded to a lot of different social venues. By screening people who enter into just normal social venues, you essentially are discriminating against people who freely choose not to take the vaccine. And I think this goes against the freedom to consent to medical treatment. If you're basically told that you have to test every single time you go to a concert, you have to do a PCR test, for example. I think that that's an invidious form of discrimination.
Do you think, though, given just the number of deaths that this virus has caused, the havoc it's wreaked, that maybe there is an argument that it is a proportionate response?
Well, on its face, that is the argument behind it, is that somehow it will reduce the number of deaths and hospitalizations caused by this virus. But I think what it's what they haven't taken into consideration is something very obvious, and that is that the people who are actually vulnerable to this virus, the people who are most vulnerable to this virus, are elderly and people with underlying diseases. So once the elderly and those with underlying diseases are able to get the vaccine, they should be able to travel perfectly safely. And the rest of the population is at a very, very low risk from COVID. So they don't, in fact, need to be vaccinated in order to travel safely and in order to attend social events safely.
From the international travel perspective, David, finally, just to ask you, what about, so people say, okay, take that, yeah, you can understand someone. I myself, for example, I'm pregnant, I'm going to choose not to get the vaccine, but would totally understand another pregnant woman taking it. You know, everyone has to make their own decision on these things and weigh up the information that they have before them. But there's a precedent from an international travel perspective in terms of having to have, for example, in certain countries, a yellow fever certificate showing that you've had your yellow fever vaccination. So is the fact that there's that precedent there, does that not make it a little bit more acceptable for needing to have something like this green cert to travel in the EU?
Well, I think that the two cases are not really comparable, because to have to certify that you've had a vaccine for, say, yellow fever is only necessary in order to travel to regions of the world, specific regions of the world, in which there is a high incidence of these rare diseases that are actually quite rare in Europe and in other parts of the world. So they actually only affect a very small fraction of the population, and they don't affect the everyday social and professional life of people who are crossing borders in Europe every day of the week. People should be clear on one thing. A vaccine passport is not only going to affect people who want to take holidays. It's going to affect people who have to travel for work reasons on a daily or weekly basis across borders, have to take flights because it's part of their work. So it will be an additional burden, a serious burden on people to be having to constantly undergo tests just in order to carry out their everyday life. It's disproportionate because, as I said before, the people who are at risk from COVID, who are seriously at risk, can vaccinate, and they will, their risks will then be greatly diminished. Not everybody needs to be vaccinated, because not everybody needs to be protected against COVID.
Thanks for joining us. That is David Thunder, political philosophy researcher and lecturer at the University of Navarra's Institute for Culture and Society in Spain. Spirit. You might have seen singer Imelda May taking to social media, talking about how people in the music industry told her as a woman over 40 she was wasting her time still making music. And it's no surprise, and thankfully her experience encouraged other female artists to speak out, saying, yeah, actually, we have these concerns, we have this experience, and the ageism that's experienced by some women in the music industry needs to stop. That's something I'm going to be talking to my next guest about, as well as what she's been up to over the last little while. It's great to have with me on the line singer-songwriter Chloe Agnew. Chloe, we might just start with that. When you saw that post from Imelda May, did it resonate with you? Did you have you had any experience of that, or any fears of that type of ageism that she's talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I think many of us have, as you mentioned, in any walk or whatever field that you're in, walk of life. But I think particularly in the music industry, yes. So when I saw Imelda's post, it really did. It hit home with me. I started out in the music industry when I was very young. I did my first single at 11 and an album at, 14, and then went on to being Celtic Woman. So I started out young in the industry, but I can't believe what I've had to experience as well in the last couple of years just as a solo artist. Only recently, as I mentioned the other day on TV, that I took a big meeting with these music executives. I was really excited about, really hopeful that we were going to be able to work together. And at the end of the meeting, they asked me what age I was. And when I told them I was 31, they looked at me and they said, yeah, we prefer if you were 21. You know, we'll be in touch. And then ultimately, when I heard from them, it was a rejection. So it broke my heart at the time. It really hurt. And I you know, when you think that these are the people who, at the end of the day, can make your career or give you the opportunities that you really want, you take those words to heart. And it's very easy to be so discouraged and think, well, what's the point in doing this? And then when somebody like Imelda comes along and smashes that out of the water and just proves all of them wrong, it gives all of us women in the industry, I think, that inspiration that we need and the faith to keep going, to doing what we're doing, and just that belief in ourselves that we don't actually need to listen to them to get to where we want to go. So I think I'm such a massive, massive Imelda fan anyway, but I think I didn't think it was possible to love her even more. And now, after seeing her just smash it out of the park for women all over the world, but particularly here in Ireland, it's just amazing.
Is that what's important, Chloe, as well, is that, there's a perception and then the reality is very different? In other words, some try to promulgate a perception about this kind of ageist thing we've been talking about, but the reality, as we've seen with the number one album that was released last week from Imelda May, is totally different.
Yes.
So is the message you're trying to get across, look, we can't let these negative reactions stop us? If anything, does it motivate you more?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I do want to believe that times are changing. You know, I mean, I think women in the industry, we do have to fight a lot harder to get to where we want to go, because I think we have to deal with, they discuss our age, they discuss our weight, what we wear, they use our emotions against us, whether we're too strong, we're not strong enough. You know, and if we speak up for what we want, then you're considered a diva or difficult, you know. And I said, if men do the same, I kind of think they're viewed as being powerful and people who know, guys who know what they want, you know. So I do think we have to come up with a load more of those issues that I don't think men do in the industry. And I do want to believe that times are changing now, and with the likes of Imelda and other people, the Why Not Her movement, and other things like that speaking up about it, I really do believe that. I want to hope people are aware of it now.
And the power of social media is it does help to amplify some of these things as well.
Absolutely.
So, Chloe, I know that you were in the middle of a tour with Celtic Women in America when the pandemic hit. What was that like? What happened next for you?
Oh, it was a rough ride. Yeah, I felt like last year, at the beginning of last year, I came home and I toasted with my family about how I felt like I had worked really hard over the last couple of years to line up a year that looked like last year in the diary. And I just, between February through to June, between Celtic Woman and a load of my own dates, I had just shy of 100 dates, you know. So I really hit me really hard when I came home. We only got 12 shows into it in the US. And at the time, we didn't know what was going on. I mean, on the Tuesday, Wednesday, we started seeing people, you know, announcing that they were cancelling their tours. And we were wondering if it was going to affect us. And then on the Thursday, that the management told us that we would be on a plane home on the Saturday. So it all happened so quickly. We landed home, I think, on the 15th of March and just didn't know what way was up, like many other people. So, yeah, it was a really strange time mentally to get my head around what happens next. And
you've managed to keep yourself busy, though, Chloe, over the last year. What have you been up to?
Thankfully, trying to keep the focus and keep the head focused on creating and you know, still doing things positively and even in the face of madness. I've been recording, I've been writing a lot, I've been involved in a load of wonderful different projects. My most recent one is with the X Collective here in Ireland, and I'm so proud of it. It's a big, talking about girl gang energy, it's an all-female track. Loads of incredible women went into making this project happen, and men too. I do have to give the guys a shout-out, but it was a predominantly female-driven project, and it's five artists, myself, Zappo, Zanita, Toshin, and Gemma Bradley. And we've just released a new song called WB, which, hey, if you listen to the lyrics of it, it's very appropriate for what we're talking about. So, yeah, I'm really proud of it. And the video is out today. And I've been writing a lot of my own music, too, and releasing that and just hanging in there in these crazy times and just hopeful that good times are going to be there ahead for us.
We're all hoping that. Really looking forward to checking out the X Collective. But we're going to play out, Chloe, today with your latest solo single release. It's called Written on My Heart. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago when I came home off the road, I had been really homesick and missing, pining for my family and home and all of that. And I came home into a little Dublin pub and with my family to see them again for Christmas. And behind me on the wall was this beautiful James Joyce quote that said, "When I die, Dublin will be written on my heart." And as a Dubliner through and through, those words really spoke to me. So I wrote this little song with my two wonderful friends, Mark Caprice and Jacob Henley. And we wrote it for anybody who thinks of wherever that place is, wherever your hometown or the place that you will always have written on your heart. We wrote it for everybody for that. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy it. It's a nice little song called Written on My Heart.
Yeah, and a poignant one for people who are living overseas and haven't been able to get home for the last year because of the pandemic. Chloe, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. That's singer-songwriter Chloe Agnew. If you want to get in touch with Chloe and see what she is up to, you can find her under name Chloe Agnew on all Instagram, Facebook, all the usual stuff. And let's play out with that song that Chloe was sharing with us a little bit about what it was about. Here is Written on My Heart on Spirit Radio.
When the sun is shining on me, but today I miss the rain. I keep thinking about the cobble streets where I fell in love with all of you. You always feel like that old friend of my eyes. Can't wait to see you again.
You know, one of the things that you might think of when you think of your children is they love playground or the schoolyard and is the favourite part of their day, but it's not always the case. And our next guest is going to chat to us about plans being put in place for a sensory garden, particularly aimed at including children with autism. And it's at a primary school in Limerick. And on the line with us, I have Maria Murphy, who's a teacher at the Angelsborough National School in Limerick. Maria, we might start with that. Tell us how the plan and the idea came about for this sensory garden in the first place.
No problem at all. I suppose the main idea it came from, we've been participating in the Autism Friendly Schools project with As I Am over the past 2 years. So as a whole school, we kind of wanted to build on our existing inclusive environment. We looked at what else we could provide for our children with autism and special education needs. So we had a number of ideas. The sensory garden probably was the main target for this year. I suppose we actually have an indoor sensory room at the moment, and we can really see the benefits of the sensory room. It just gives the children an area where they can feel safe and secure, a space where they can go if they become a little overwhelmed or a little anxious. So really we just wanted to create a similar safe, inclusive space outdoors for the children. We just felt it'd be nice so they could express their own unique individual personalities. I suppose a place where their senses are stimulated, a place where they can experience a variety of textures, tastes and sounds and smells. So that was kind of the idea behind it, just looking at the kids and seeing what they needed within our school environment.
So what will the garden look like? What sorts of things are going to go into it, Maria? Especially, you know, there might be people listening who would think, wow, I'd love to be able to even include some of those things in my garden or talk to my school about doing something like this.
Yeah, so we actually have the garden planned and it's up and running at the moment. So I suppose we started at the start of the year, we sat down with the garden committee and we came up with a plan and we kind of looked at the children and their needs and kind of decided what exactly we think should go into the garden for the specifically for the children's needs. So I suppose it depends on the children and whatever we put in this year might change for next year depending on the needs of the kids. So things that we included, we put in a trampoline, we have a sandbox, we have a mirror, we have a blackboard, we have a little fairy garden, we have a car, we have a ball and shoot game. So like we just focused on the special interests of the kids. Like I know one of the kids, his special interest is cars and vans, so we created a car using like a pallet, recyclable materials, old steering wheels and old school chairs. We took the legs off the school chairs and just painted it up, so we knew that that was kind of like an invitation for him to play in this special space for them. And then we also have loads of different plants and herbs and vegetables and all that. So that's kind of what we have included. But as I said, it'll be changing.
I know, I love, Maria, just how you're highlighting to tailor it towards individual students and their likes and the things that will work for them. What are your hopes for the garden? I know you've already mentioned some of the sensory things you've done before the garden and you've seen the benefits. But what sort of a benefit can a sensory garden like this give to young people with autism?
I suppose there's many benefits, really. Sensory gardens, they can help with anxiety, with fidgeting, with poor attention skills. I suppose the children will have access to this space each and every day. So I suppose when we go into the garden, the aim is we hope when the children return to the classroom that they're calmed and regulated and they're ready to learn again. We'll also be using the sensory gardens like for teaching and learning. We hope to kind of continue to teach the children about the importance of caring for the environment, the different plants, the different vegetables, watering the plants, feeding the plants. And we'll also hope to harvest the vegetables and the fruits. So when we're doing our cooking classes on Fridays and that, we'll be teaching the children about harvesting and preparing food. So it's all kind of teaching and learning within the classroom, out in the sensory garden, just keeping the children happy and content and calm. Just in that inclusive environment, really.
What a great initiative, Maria. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme today. That's Maria Murphy, teacher at the Angelsborough National School in County Limerick. Spirit. So we've seen primary and secondary schools return, but most college students around the country have pretty much had a year of online learning. And now they're preparing to virtually sit their college exams at home. So how will this work? How do you stay motivated? And what advice do we have for students to just prepare well? On the line to give us her advice on this, we have Midlands-based guidance counsellor Betty McLaughlin. Betty, first of all, you might explain how exactly are college exams going to work for those who are sitting them?
Well, for those who are sitting, a lot of students will have already sat them in December or during the year. But how they work is that you literally log on, you're given a specific amount of time. They are timed. They are monitored with sequence specific software just so that there can be no cheating and so on. And that's really it. But, you know, the advice I would give to students, really, there are a few things they can do to take the stress out of it, really. firstly, it's vitally important that they log in good time and be ready at their computer waiting, because if some students, the way the exams work, that once it starts, if you don't show up on time, you could be locked out altogether. So that's an absolute essential. You know, all online exams, they're timed, which means you really have to carve out an uninterrupted block of time for your test with no interruptions around the house and all that. So know the time of the exam, how much time you're going to have, and vital to make sure that your computer is ready and in 100% working order, and that the software needed for the exam that you would have got in a lot of cases from, you would have been able to download from your college, make sure that you have practiced it and that you're used to using it. Another thing then, there are some exams that are open book, and this can be a catch for students, really, because the questions based on the open book or open note, if you like, they're very much very short. And if you don't know where to access the information, if you haven't prepared in advance and are not ready, you won't find it within the time that's required to answer the question. So to just really be prepared, really know where your answers are and have your reading done in advance.
And as you say, Betty, important for everybody in the house who's not sitting exams to get clear and give the students sitting the exam the time and space they need. How does it work? You mentioned there obviously the open book exams, but what about closed book ones in terms of supervision?
Yeah, well, the thing is that there isn't a monitoring of, like, they can't call to people's houses and supervise, so there's a lot of trust in it. However, as I said, they do have that software. The colleges will have that to ensure that they can detect if there's any cutting and pasting, or if any two students are copying or giving the same or sharing notes with each other. You know, there are checks there, but in general, you know, students will do it with integrity and they'll give it their best shot.
And in terms of just the preparation piece and all that sort of stuff, for those who might be thinking, you know, some people, Betty, for example, the adrenaline of going into the exam hall, okay, yes. And the yes. whole experience and the chats with people before, and even the aftermath, you know, students who think, Cheney, when I come out of an exam, sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm upset, and having that camaraderie and the chat afterwards, that's all gone. How would you advise students to cope with that?
It's a huge loss, but a lot of them have little chat groups and study groups, and just keep connected with each other and keep talking, you know, for the moment. That's as good as it gets, really, because certainly that camaraderie, that support that was there before is a big loss to students at the moment. But try and have your chat groups, your study chats, your WhatsApp, and, you know, do a Zoom call, a little, you know, a debrief after it, if that's what helps you.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.